Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this June 5th, 2021. We have begun June in Texas, which I'm going to make a prediction. My prediction is that things are going to start heating up around here, that things are start, I would actually even say hot. It's going to get hot over the next several months. I know I'm going out on a limb making this prediction, but, you know, I'm going to take the easy ones where I can get them and the hard ones where I can get them. So just wait and see if I'm right. See if it doesn't get hot around here for the next couple of months. What do you think? What's your thought on that?
I think there's a high probability, although I will say that normally at the beginning of June, we have warmer weather than we're having right now.
That is true.
But we're having a very wet spring.
And as summer begins, I suspect that it will get hot.
And drier.
And dry. So that is my prediction for the day. Folks, please hold me to it. Not certain.
It's a high probability.
Past performance is no guarantee of future summers.
That's true.
Please read the prospectus carefully before putting on your sunscreen. Right. So this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We are quite tongue-in-cheek, sometimes so much that we bite our tongue while chewing. So if we start slurring our speech, that is likely the reason. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with me I have
Jeff McClure.
And we are going to do our best to de-befuddle. Is it unfuddle? The market, the economy. And we have a question. It was only sent to me, though. You weren't included. So this one's mine. This is from Marty. Will the dollar go away and all my savings be gone? How do you protect the dollar? Land value could be taxed out of existence. Okay. So this seems a bit extreme, and I think a lot of people would look at that and say, no, the dollar's not going to go away. No, that there are times in history where this has happened, not with the dollar, but yeah, with the dollar too. We've had times in the history of the United States where the dollar became absolutely worthless. This took place multiple periods. The Continental Congress had established its first dollar, and did people still say not worth a continental dollar? Which kind of throws me for a loop because I don't know anybody that actually used one. But we also had a similar situation take place in the 1830s. The Great Depression of 1837 caused our dollars to be pretty much worthless if it wasn't backed by something that the international community valued. And there's all kinds of history behind that. So before we say, hey, this is never going to happen, let's go to actually the question here. How do you protect the dollar? The Federal Reserve, that's its mandate. That is the congressional mandate in the Federal Reserve Act. It is the primary purpose of this organization of private banks that has a quasi-governmental existence. The president nominates the top members of the Federal Reserve Board, and those members then have to be approved by the Senate. So what is it that they do? You were just talking at the end of last hour about the Federal Reserve monetizing debt and so on. The Federal Reserve, when it raises and lowers interest rates, it makes money more expensive or less expensive. The more expensive money is, the more it will buy. The less expensive money is, the less it will buy. That's inflation and deflation and reverse order there. So if money is less expensive and you can have more of it, that's inflation. If money's more expensive and you have less of it, but it buys more, that's deflation. The Federal Reserve's job is to try to soak up excess money out of the economy that would cause inflation and to pump money in when we're in a deflationary scenario. And we've been in deflationary scenarios and inflationary scenarios in the last 10 years. So they've done their job fairly well in that we haven't had runaway inflation and we haven't had runaway deflation. We're having some weirdness. And the last piece on here about land value being taxed out of existence, this is another case where there's lots of times in history where this has been the case, where taxes went up so high that it was impossible to actually own land unless you were the government. It's happened in lots of countries, including the United States, although it hasn't been a case in the United States for quite a long, long time. Texas is one of the least likely places for it to happen. Texas has one of the best individual property rights set of laws out of any state in the union, and the United States has better individual property rights than almost any other country on the planet. So it's good that we stay nervous around the concept that, because taxes go up, and if you looked at your, if you own any property and you've looked at your appraisal at the county, it doesn't matter if you're in Florida or Texas or Nevada or Connecticut, the values have gone up drastically. And part of that is just look around. If you are trying to sell a house, you'll find that values have gone up drastically. One of the problems with property taxes, ad valorem taxes, is that you're not selling anything or creating anything that produces money that allows you to pay the tax bill. That's always a danger in valuing something that hasn't been sold and then charging a tax on it. Because if the only way to pay the tax on your property is to sell the property, then you're in a real problem. And we have that as a problem still today. It's not a huge problem. It's not something that a lot of people face. But when you do have that problem, it's big.
Presuming that the Biden tax law goes through as has been proposed, which is a big presumption, it could create a problem for capital gains, because traditionally, no matter how much property you had, no matter how much wealth you had, at your death, assuming you're not passing it to your wife, we're just talking about the single person dying and passing it to their heirs or passing it to the husband. Let me rephrase that. Passing it to a spouse.
There you go.
The capital gains tax is forgiven on the property that you have, and the basis of the property, the purchase price of the property, in essence, jumps to whatever the value was at your death. One of the proposals that President Biden has put before Congress, and I think it's going to get modified, is that if you have more than $1 million in gains, then you get $1 million exemption. Anything above $1 million in gains gets taxed at the capital gain. Well, actually, it was at the capital gains rate or the regular rate?
The capital gains rate's going up to the 39.6%.
Yeah, but
that's a proposal.
It gets taxed. It does get taxed at your death.
Right.
In other words, the capital gains are captured at your death. Now,
there's a series of changes there as well. The estate tax rules are also being thrown out in there. Basically, the idea in this plan is that if you have more than $1 million in gains, this is not written anywhere, just as a side note. There's no actual official version of what the bill is supposed to be. This is just the leaks and the rumors, and this is what they're negotiating. The Biden concept is that if you have more than $1 million in gains at the death, then that's going to get taxed as well. So,
well, the capital gains tax is a completely different thing from the estate tax. It's $11.7 million, and he hasn't proposed to reduce per person.
Right.
So a husband and wife could actually... 23 billion dollars.
Million. It'd be nice if it were billion, but no.
I don't know it'd be nice, but it can shelter up to 23 million. So the estate tax is no longer a problem. The issue is that doesn't apply to 401ks, by the way.
Right.
Doesn't apply to deferred, anything that you have is a deferred tax vehicle, such as variable annuity or 401k. But they have to be paid out over a 10-year period.
There's even confusion on that. The IRS has come out with some very conflicting regulations, like basically saying the regulation that we just quoted is wrong, even though they're not quoting that regulation. So it's very confusing. The CPAs are very concerned.
The IRS is going to correct that. They basically said you still have to make your required minimum distributions, even though the law doesn't say anything about required minimum distributions. I think the IRS will correct that at some point. It was in their guidance.
They did correct it, but they corrected it this week or the end of last week. They corrected the guidance by making it even more confusing. So both sets of guidance were typo-ridden and making references to the wrong portions of the law. And so if you really wish to set off a nerd hornet's nest, go to a group of CPAs and mention RMDs on beneficiary IRAs. And I say that with a great deal of compliment, by the way. We consider ourselves to be nerds, of very high level nerds. So a group of CPAs, just go say beneficiary IRA and then get your earplugs ready, because the confusion level right now on this subject is just right through the roof. And that's with a law that's actually been passed, that we actually have verbiage in written form. So when we're talking about new capital gains stuff, we're talking about new changes to anything. Don't get ahead. We'll have plenty of time to be upset. Don't worry. Don't get upset about the rumors. Wait till it's written down. Then we can all get upset together.
What I want to see is, and since the Trump tax reduction 2017.
Yeah, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
There's no proposal to revoke it.
The President Biden, in his negotiation this week on the infrastructure bill, said that he would leave it alone. He would leave alone the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act if they would continue negotiations.
One of the nice things that he decided to leave alone, if you happen to own a small business as we do, is you get a 20% tax treatment if you have a closely held small business.
A 20% deduction on the income that you make as pass-through income, yeah. Right? Pass-through.
Yeah, income.
Yeah. Where it comes from the business to the owner.
So that's very helpful. It's interesting that what's the interesting thing about all the Biden tax proposals, by the way, is how little the changes are. If you don't have more than $1 million in gains somewhere, either in land or in property or in your stock accounts that are not tax deferred like a 401k or something, then it has very little effect on you. Now, if you make more than if you as an individual make more than $400,000, yeah, your rates are going to go up. But the funny thing is, the strange thing is, I don't care who was elected president at this point, given the amount of debt we've accumulated bursting ourselves out of this recession, I think it's pretty clear that the taxes had to go up. We've been saying that for a year. Actually, been saying it for 2 years, but it's true. The taxes will have to go up. And as a matter of fact, the actual tax, the Tax Reform and Job Act pumps the taxes back up to where they were if nothing changes in 2025 anyway. So taxes are going to go up. One of the things you can probably depend on, just like there's no certainty it's going to get hot this summer, but there's a very high probability. There's no certainty that taxes are going to be higher in the future than they are today, but there's certainly a very high probability. We spend a lot of money. By the way, while we're at it, if I could go on.
Absolutely.
There's a parallel in history. I've seen several articles that said we've never seen a recovery like this one. Actually, we have.
It's just been a long time.
Just that there's nobody around it who's professionally advising on money, who was professionally advising on investments back then. And that is following World War II. At the end of World War II, we had a brief short but relatively severe recession, not unlike the one we have seen as the pandemic caused. And the government had figured out, the Congress and everybody else had figured out that we didn't want to repeat the Great Depression, which was at least partially caused by the monetary policy following World War I. And so they pumped money into the economy, the GI Bill. I mean, they basically loaned money to anybody who wanted to borrow money, just about small business loans. A lot of things came into effect following World War II to pump the economy up and pump it full of money. We had a short burst of inflation, a tremendous run up in the stock market, and then the inflation just faded away with the stimulus. Let me throw one other thing in. taxes went up to pay off the war debt.
Right.
And I think we'll see that happen this time too.
So one of, and to give further parallel, because we can say, how is this anything like that? Well, it's the only other time. And again, we don't have numbers from this era. This is not something, we were not tracking unemployment numbers at this point. There's studies that have gone back that have tried to estimate, but it's hard enough to do it in real time. It's extremely hard to do, to track how many people have jobs. But what we can say with a great deal of confidence is that a lot of people in the United States lost their jobs right after World War II. How can I say that? Because we militarized. We had the war effort going in large amount. We had a large percentage of our population was involved in the war effort. What happens when the war's done? Well, you have unemployment. You have a lot of it. A lot of people left the military. They weren't laid off. You don't get laid off from the military.
You get discharged.
You get discharged. So how do you count that as far as layoff numbers? You've been discharged honorably. You did good service. Now you're coming back. You have the GI Bill. Some people went to school. Now they're not in the economy. You got a lot of people coming home. There's a demand for stuff that there wasn't a supply for. Sound familiar? People were looking around trying to figure out what job they were going to do. Demand's going through the roof. Not enough people are working, but everybody's out of work. So there's not enough people to fill all the jobs, but unemployment is really high. This is a parallel that we're looking at. And you had something to add here?
Yeah, the number of new businesses that are being created right now parallels that following World War II.
That's right.
A lot of the guys coming back off the GI Bill, and they had money left over from their pay they hadn't spent. They decided to start a small business, and that's happening right now too. We also had, and this is, again, as Jake said, it's hard to track these numbers precisely. We also had a short-term labor shortage.
And you can see that in newspapers. Yeah, when you're looking at newspapers for the time period, the help wanted and the confusion about how people, there's so many people complaining about being out of work, but I've been trying to hire people for the last 3 months. Those stories are in those newspapers, and they're worth looking back at. They're worth reading. It's fascinating stuff because it's the same headlines that we're seeing today.
The good news is, and it's really good news, is the inflation went away by the 1950s. You recall the war ended in 1946, so we actually had a recession in 1949. But as we went into the 1950s, the inflation faded away. The economy went on a boom, and we went into the post-World War II economic boom.
And we paid back a lot of the government debt.
But taxes went up to the 90% bracket. For some people, in high-income people paid a lot of taxes. Well, actually, didn't pay that many taxes because there were a lot of loopholes.
Right. Very similar to today's taxes.
Nobody was paying actually 90% taxes. They had a high tax rate. And the CPAs across the country were making a good living.
One of the things that I can look at, this is something I studied for a long time, this period, because it has that 90% tax bracket, the effective tax rate was still about 21%. And it had been for a period about 18%, which we saw the debt going up, the spending was going up, and we were hanging around about 18%. We're about a 20% effective tax rate right now, and it's not enough to pay for what we're spending on. The long-term average in the United States is about 23% effectively for everybody. We've got some room to move up, and as long as we're talking about a 2% differential, this is not going to break anybody's bank. And I mean, not unless they're just I don't know. I guess there are some people that could break the bank. There's no foolproof statement that can be made about anybody can go broke at any point.
It does require some planning, though. If you're going to sell a small business, or let's say you have a store and you're going to sell it, or you have a ranch or farm and you're going to sell it, you do need to have a strategy now so that you don't capture all that income in 1 year. That's important because you can have, you can be relatively low income, below $400,000 even.
That's not considered income. Low income by most people.
Well, for tax purposes, the taxes go up above $400,000. But the fact that you sell a big piece of property or a lot of stock that you inherited or something in a short period of time, can throw you into the very highest tax bracket suddenly and be very, very damaging to you. It's really important if you're going to sell something and convert it to cash or convert it to something else that you consult with a tax professional,
right,
CPA or a tax attorney, and be very careful about what you're doing there because you could inadvertently trigger higher taxes. And the interesting thing about this is the budget proposal presumes that this that the tax changes that finally get enacted, which will be sometime this year, are retroactive back to at least April.
Yeah. So there's not a way to get out of this. There's a lot of folks that are saying, hey, let's not make it retroactive, but it's out of our hands. And we don't know what the final event's going to be. What you were just saying, there's strategies that you can use. And this is one, we've mentioned this on the air before. It's one that you can use even if the tax law doesn't change. If you're selling your business or your farm or a house that's worth a lot more than the $500,000 limit on capital gains number, if you can do this in a way that spreads the sale out over multiple years, you should do it. It's true today. It's been true for decades because there's an arbitrary number in the calendar called January 1. And this is an example I've used quite a lot to show that there's problems with the tax code. If you're a business or you own a business and you're saving for a large purchase, and it's going to take multiple years of savings to get that large purchase if you don't want to go into debt, and you've almost got enough money, you'll get enough money for it next month at this time, but the next month is in January, well, you've still got to pay taxes on all the gains, and use air quotes, the bunny quotes are coming in around this, on the gains that you have. You've been saving up for this thing. You haven't reinvested it into the business, so it's considered a gain. Well, you get taxed on that. Even though next month you're going to spend it on something that would make it not a gain, it would be a reinvestment. There's an arbitrary day that just pops up and says, hey, now you owe taxes on that. If you paid the check tomorrow to buy the thing, it's going to cost you $30,000 more than if you did it today. And that's an inefficiency in our system, but it's been there since we've had an income tax. We measure that stuff starting in a calendar year. So don't just assume every day is like every other day. If you can spread out two checks to get one in one day and one the next day through an escrow settlement or something, you can lower your tax bill, significantly lower your tax bill. And I'm going to hand it back to you for a minute.
Well, it basically boils down to the fact if you have a relatively high dollar net worth and you're not going to leave it exactly as it is, it's probably a good idea to talk to a professional. And by a professional, I don't mean your local tax preparer, although they do a good job of preparing taxes. Somebody who is a certified public accountant who is a fiduciary or a tax attorney. Now, if you don't happen to be one of those people, well, God bless you. You're like the rest of us. And you just get by with what you can do. The tax changes seem to affect people who are multimillionaires. And I say multimillionaires because if you have, let's say you had $2 million in your investment accounts outside of IRAs, then if you have a $1 million in gain in there, you're exceptional. You're up there. You're up in the upper 1-2% of the nation. So if you've got that problem, you can afford to talk to a professional, and you should talk to a professional. If you don't have that problem, you really don't have a problem with the new tax bill, the new tax proposal. It's not a bill yet.
Yeah, and that's the – a lot of this is firmly still in negotiation. We've got an education bill, an infrastructure bill, and a tax bill. So the tax bill is how we pay for our existing budget and these new things. And that's what's being negotiated now. So there's a lot of confusion on the subject because there's nothing final yet.
There's another thing that probably didn't make the local paper, but if you take the Wall Street Journal or something, it's headlines. And that is there's been an agreement on international taxing. In other words, right now, for example, Ireland has very, very low taxes on corporations. So corporations move their profits to Ireland, so they can do on paper. So they pay very little corporate income tax. And having a universal 15% minimum tax is major. Now, why 15% minimum tax? Corporations, for instance, by buying money-losing companies, which they can pay a pittance for because the company's lost a lot of money over the years, but that company has accumulated a lot of losses they can carry forward on their taxes. So by buying those companies, they can capture those losses, make them part of their own corporation, and avoid paying taxes, even though they have plenty of profit on the corporation. That's about to go out the window to some degree, because the 15% minimum tax, basically, if a corporation carries it on its books and says to its investors, we had whatever our income was, or not our income, but whatever our profit was for the year, they have to pay 15% of that to the government, minimum. Now, obviously, if they made a big profit and they don't have a lot of tax credits to carry forward, they may pay it more than that. But that's the big thing is the G7 nations, and I suspect they will put pressure on the ones that aren't in the G7, have all agreed that they're going to tax at the same rate, the same minimum rate, which makes it a level playing field. Right now, it's not a level playing field. Some places tax more, some places tax less. We're in the more column. So a lot of money gets moved, a lot of profits get moved on paper outside the United States for the purpose of avoiding taxes. And there's been a major step in the right direction towards avoiding, towards eliminating that problem.
And I would actually like to expound on this. I know this sounds really dry on the surface, where you're talking about the G7, universal, across the board, we're making tax agreement that says we're not going to charge less than 15%. What does that have to do with anything? Why are you going to expound on this? Let me give you some examples. The laws in the United States and in Europe and in places all over the globe have been changing lately, being in the last decade. In Europe, there's something called GDPR. It's a privacy law that if you're watching the news on Facebook and Google and them being sued in European courts over GDPR, it has to do with where they're housing the data for their customers. And so Facebook's housing its data on a server somewhere. And the whole idea of the cloud is it's everywhere, right? If one goes down, you've got the others other places. Well, GDPR in Europe says you're not allowed to hold that data outside of Europe, physically outside of Europe, which doesn't coincide very well with how the internet works. So if you have a friend in Europe who is a Facebook friend of yours, and you have the ability to access their Facebook page, which you should, Facebook's in violation of GDPR now, because that data is now being stored in the United States on your computer as well. So there's a this nasty tangled mess, and that's not even getting into other things. Like, if you're an American living overseas, you have a bank, hopefully, you're making money, hopefully, overseas, and somebody's paying you, and that money goes into a bank. But because you're an American citizen, a lot of banks in other countries won't take you as a customer. In well-known countries, this is not only in Argentina you can't get a bank. No, it's in almost every country on the planet. It is extremely hard for an American living abroad to get a bank account, because as soon as they have one American customer, the entirety of their customer relationship with all of their customers is available for the IRS's perusal. And if they don't allow the IRS to do it, they're not allowed to do business in the United States, which is where the majority of the money markets are. So when I say the money markets, that's how money gets moved around. It used to be in London, and with the Brexit, Manhattan is again, or for the first time, the financial capital of the world. Money moving through the United States is normal, even if you're a European bank. If you have an American customer, you get limited on how you do that, unless you just want to open up all your books to the IRS. So GDPR is an issue. The IRS has issues. We got American tax laws that reach out into foreign countries. And then right in the middle of this, if you have investments, if you're investing and you live in France or in Italy or in Australia, you've got tax law overlaps that are just absolutely absurd. If you have investments because you're an American in the United States at the same time that you have investments in Australia or, say, France, the fact that you're now living in Europe, if you're in France, means that you're subject to GDPR, which means that you can't house your investment information for this person in the United States, but the SEC says you're not allowed to house it anywhere else. So you can see that there's a convoluted mess as far as tax laws go, as far as privacy laws go, and we have been moving farther and farther and farther apart for the last probably 15 years across the globe. It's been getting a smaller world, but much, much, much more complicated. This is the first step in simplifying that. The reason why these tax laws are so aggressive against each other is because the countries involved aren't agreeing the way they used to on how taxes work. And you're ready to talk now.
I'll talk about something else. Change the job. There's an elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned.
It's a
nice elephant. It's a very sweet, kind, gentle elephant.
I hope you have a good shovel.
I do.
Oh, good.
Payrolls. We used to talk about the payrolls, and they were stuck. Payroll reports, which comes out every week, was stuck at about 700,000 for months.
700,000 payrolls?
Plus 700,000 layoffs.
Layoffs. There we go.
It's called the payroll report.
Yeah.
And instead of that, we had a 278,000. I'm sorry. We had 100 and what I missed. Yeah, 200 some thousand dollar layoff this year, this month, this week. But the big news is, the net hiring in the month of May is 559,000.
That's a big deal. That's a
really
big deal.
It was 278,000 in April. The unemployment rate fell to 5.8% in May, which is still sounds really high compared to 3.5% unemployment we had in February of 2020.
But just as a side note, when I first started my career, which was now before the hills got dusty, but we're talking about 20 plus, we'll say that, 30 years ago, the unemployment rate of 6% was considered full employment when I started my career. Yep. They said if you ever got below 6%, you were going to have runaway inflation, because 6% was just the where we thought we need to have 6% unemployed at any given time to make sure that we can fill jobs when they open up.
Of course, we're having trouble filling jobs when they open up right now.
Right.
Which is a huge conundrum, by the way. The expectation, by the way, for this for the month was 1 million new jobs. We got 559,000. And it's still a big question as to why people are not working. And I know that there's a lot of knee-jerk reaction, but only a relatively small percentage of the people who are not working or looking for jobs are in fact drawing unemployment insurance. So the extra $300 is going to have some effect. About 15-20% of the people who are not working but are looking for jobs are drawing unemployment insurance. Now, we'll see in the next month or two, we're going to see some changes. 27 states, I think it is now. I may have messed up on the number. It's 13 or 27 states have cut off the extra $300 unemployment insurance.
Right.
If that was the cause of people not working, then we'll see employment jump dramatically over the next couple of months.
The Texas Tribune has a really good article on this subject. The headline is, "Without childcare, Texas's unemployed mothers are struggling to re-enter the workforce as federal benefits cease." And that's kind of ubiquitous across the country. Childcare, it's one of the most impacted areas of COVID because they generally have the lowest margins and the lowest reserves. And when you don't have kids in the building, you got to lay off your employees.
You lose your lease.
You lose your lease. Then how do you get started back up? You've got all kinds of licensing requirements no matter where you are to get started back up. You got to make sure it's safe. Obviously, this is a good idea. You don't want to have childcare facilities that are not safe. But it's a large process. It's a large buildup to get this going. And so when you yank a bunch of them out and then say, all right, we're going back, it takes a while. And when you don't have flexibility in your hours, it means you're limited on what childcare options you have. I think where he's going with that is that when you lay off folks in childcare, they go and get other jobs, or the childcare facility goes away. Getting in the new childcare facility is difficult.
The problem with it is that those people who got laid off who were working in childcare in many cases found jobs someplace else. It's not hard to find a job right now. And in many cases found jobs that paid them more than childcare, which means that for the childcare facility to open back up again, they have to raise the cost bringing your child in. And for people at low income position, particularly, which is where we're missing a lot of the employees, raising the cost of childcare makes it economically infeasible for them to go back to work. And that's a problem we need to figure out some way of addressing. And by the way, one of the bills that the president has proposed to Congress does do that exactly. It gives supplemental income to childcare providers, thereby allowing childcare to be less expensive. Other places in the world, in some states like Connecticut, do provide state support for childcare providers.
Yeah, on that.
And in doing so, they have higher employment rates.
We've talked quite a lot about demographics over the last several weeks and several years and several decades. China just came out with its three-child policy correction. We talked about that last week. Just 5 years ago, it went from a one-child to two-child policy. And now they're saying three children because the census numbers are saying their population is shrinking and they're getting older. And so when they met, they said, hey, this is not a good trend. Let's give some incentives. We're going to start paying for childcare for people that are having kids because otherwise we're not going to have enough kids long term. Obviously, that's a communist concept, but so is public school. Having the ability for the kid to go to school, period, is a communist concept. It's a socialist concept of how do we provide education to make a better workforce, which is capitalist. So we have this weird hodgepodge. When we're talking about this area of childcare, this pre-kindergarten area of childcare, which is the hardest area to fill up, you're hitting the lowest and least paid people, which are also the people that are most likely to be off of their employment. We got lots more to talk about. That's maybe the big key. The elephant in the room there was that, I think. We talk about other things as the elephant in the room, but this is the reason why the recovery is lagging, is that it's the supply-demand issue again.
Well, there's another reason the recovery is lagging. We can talk about that too, and that is the fact that the delivery times, we've got the ISM indexes for manufacturing and for services, and both of them are showing the highest delivery times since they've been measured.
Yeah.
And the most expensive deliveries.
So we'll talk more about that and what it means on the other side of these commercials. If you'd like to join the conversation, our email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side. Back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the line with
me,
I have
Jeff McClure.
Together, we are the bald duo or balding duo. Are you still balding?
Are you balded? I think I'm balded. I think I've got as bald as I'm going to get.
I think so. I think at this point, on in your life, you're simply going to get hairier.
But I'm not bald-faced, either of you.
Neither am I. Neither of us are bald-faced. We are bearded, so we are not bald-faced in any way.
We cannot be bald-faced liars.
Correct. We are...
It's a good sign.
Nor can we be bald-faced truth-tellers. We're just simply not bald-faced. But bald-nosed. Definitely bald-nosed.
So we're talking about the ISM reports.
Yes.
And that's the Institute for Service Management, Institute for Supply Management. And they do this report where they go out and talk to the people who buy stuff for businesses because they can figure out how businesses are doing by how much stuff they're ordering in advance. So the supply managers at the various businesses, whether it's a restaurant, which is a service business, or a manufacturing business, order stuff, and they have a good feel for what's coming down the road. The ISM for the service area, let's see, I've got to look at it. I've got to find it here again. It's 70, the supplier deliveries index rate is 70.4. Let's see, 62.7.
All of these are in massive growth.
No, I'm sorry, 64% for services, which is the highest it's ever been. That's the fastest growing since we've measured the ISM index for services. Probably would be this high following World War II. But the deliveries are slow at 70. The higher the number above 50, the bigger the disparity is here, which means that businesses are having slow deliveries and the things that they're ordering are costing more, which is slowing things down across the board. And eventually that'll pick up.
And you most likely, our listeners have experienced it. If you're ordering anything online, you know, the whole prime shipping thing that everybody, you know, one day shipping or 2 day shipping, it's, you're lucky if you get a 1 day or 2 day shipping these days. It's pretty unlikely that that is normal to have 1 or 2 day shipping actually occur. And in my own anecdotal, you know, tracking of this, we've ordered several things over the last several weeks, and none of them have come in on time. This is true whether you're getting it through U.S. Postal Service, FedEx, UPS, through private shipping to get it to a corporation. Everything is slower because there are backlogs of things at factories, not enough trucks to get them off the lot or to a ship. To a port, not enough containers to get them on the ship, not enough ships to get them all to where they're supposed to go. And then when they get there, not enough trucks and truck drivers to get them to where they're going to the next stop. So every point along the chain has shortages, and that's going to take some time to get this all figured out. And there's a lot of people that will get jobs out of this, and there's probably people that are going to lose their jobs over it. All that's saying is that we're in such a big boom. Things are so good that we're not really sure how to handle it yet. We got to figure that out. It's a good problem to have, though. Would you agree with that?
I think it's a good problem to have, and I think it'll solve itself. If prices rise on the supplies and they stay up, then we'll develop more capacity to fill those supply gaps.
If it's profitable to do it, we'll do it. Yeah, it just takes time.
The investment in productivity is rising at a 5.4% annualized rate right now.
That
this was in the first quarter.
That is fantastic. I suspect that we're going to see a larger increase in productivity in the second quarter.
And you say 5.4% annual, that doesn't sound like very much. Well, it is actually a lot when you consider that the last 20 years, the productivity in the United States rose at 1% or 2% a year. It's rising at a rate of 5.4% a year. Now, part of that is the fact that people are just working harder and being more efficient. But the other side of that is there's a lot of money being spent. There's a 15% annualized rate of investment in new equipment. A lot of that new equipment is automating equipment. Because it's become very obvious to a lot of employers, and this is a long-term trend.
Yeah, lots of factories being developed in the Midwest, huge numbers of factories being developed in the Midwest, far more than what we've seen over the last several decades. It's like Chinese level of factory growth that we are, now that's going to take years. These things don't get built overnight. unless you're Tesla, and then they can build it in like 3 months. But
and a lot of factories and a lot of places, they're automating things. And again, we've seen this start in McDonald's, where you can go to the front, go to a kiosk and order your meal. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that go on, because employers have become aware of the fact it's getting hard. It's hard to control their labor. It's hard to get it when you need it. It's hard to get rid of it when you don't need it. And I think we're going to see a tremendous surge in automation. And again, this takes time. This is a multi-year process. But I think employers have been burned badly enough on this that they'll spend the money that's necessary to get the job done.
Right. So all of that, as rough as we're talking about with the supply shortages and the price spikes and all of that, all of those are signs of good things coming. If you're trying to buy something and it's a lot more expensive than it was, read almost any car, any house, any plumber, any electrician, just know that over time, this is going to get fixed. If it stays this profitable to be a plumber, they're going to hire more plumbers. If it stays this profitable to sell used cars, it would mean that no new cars continue to get made forever. And that's not reasonable.
I think that will correct itself. Yeah. I think that will correct itself. What we'll get is more chip plants, and we'll get the new car manufacturers to come back up to speed.
Taiwan as a nation, not as the government, but as the whole group in Taiwan, they have a large number of chip factories under construction in Arizona and in Texas. And yes, this is happening here because it's cheaper to transport the chip from the factory in the United States to the other factory in the United States than it is to ship it from Taiwan. I know that's hard to understand, but it's true. As long as the workforce is automated. Otherwise, it's a lot more expensive to use Americans to do the work because we're generally better qualified and better educated than our competitors elsewhere in the world.
And the other thing is the Taiwan-based companies are a little bit nervous about being concentrated on that island. First, yes. It's having the worst drought it's had in 50 years.
And
secondly, there is the next-door neighbor who wants to invade it.
Yes, there's a fleet buildup happening. Anytime your neighbor is stacking tanks outside your property line, it might cause you to be a little nervous. And Taiwan is definitely looking at that. The Economist at the end of May had a cover that said the most dangerous place on the planet. And it was a picture of Taiwan. And it's kind of a picture from a radar perspective of the radar line going around in a circle. And to the north and west is China, and there's a massive fleet, and there's a flag over the fleet that shows it's Chinese. And then to the south and the east, there's a massive fleet, and it's got an American flag over it. Taiwan's right there in the middle. So, yeah, they are investing in diversifying their ability to stay independent.
Pretty interesting article in The Economist that said we're a little short on the Navy right now.
Yes, we are more than a little short on the Navy right now.
We only had one carrier operating in the Pacific, an old one, and it got moved into the Persian Gulf to cover the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
We have 5 of our carriers in dry dock right now. That is huge.
Which long-term is a good thing.
Yeah.
But we're about out of time.
Yeah. So if you'd like to talk to us off the air, if you'd want to get our information, you can call locally. There's voicemail on the weekend, real live people during the week.
254-947-1111.
Or you can call that same line toll free, 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts and recordings of our program going back lots of time. Sign up for our newsletter, read our newsletter. You can contact us through the contact form, or our phone numbers are on there as well. And you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.